Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Roseanne Cash has been writing and performing on stage for more than three decades. In her new memoir, titled Composed, she writes, "I have often attempted to explain my experiences to myself through songs. Part of those experiences involved being the daughter of legendary singer Johnny Cash. Roseanne Cash recently released a CD based on a list her father gave her when she was a teenager. He called it 100 Essential Country Songs. The CD is entitled The List, and let's listen to one of those songs.
I've got your picture that you gave to me, and it's signed with love, just like it used to be. She's got you. I've got the records that we used to share, and they still sound the same as when you were here. The only thing different, the only thing new, I've got the records. She's got you.
Roseanne Cash, what a pleasure to meet you.
My honor to be on your show.
Thank you. And to hear you sing that Patsy Cline song, tell me what it was like for you to sing that song, which I know was a favorite of your mother's.
That was perhaps the most intimidating song to approach from the list.
Really?
Thinking about recording it. In fact, I kept saying to my husband, John, who produced and arranged the record, I said, I can't do a song that Patsy Cline did. And he said, well, think about it. It's been over 40 years since she sang that song. There's a whole generation that perhaps never heard it. And ultimately, I think a great song deserves a lot of interpretations.
So your interpretation finally felt is?
It felt authentic. At one point in the studio, I asked Patsy to help me.
And I'll bet she did.
Well, in a metaphorical way, maybe she did.
She did. This, the title of your memoir, Composed,
yes,
has lots of meanings, I would think.
Sure. Well, it references some measure of grace that I hope I've attained at this, you know, my old age. but also it's about compositions, you know, writing music for all of these years.
But that state of feeling composed,
yes,
is something that takes a long while.
It does. I mean, if you grow into learning a skill, you grow into becoming a good wife and mother, you grow into being feeling at home on the stage, or at least I did. And, you know, ultimately, I got rid of my reflex resistance to my dad's legacy and trying to do this on my own. I want to carve out my own spot, which is totally appropriate as a young woman, but not very graceful as a middle-aged woman. So that, the title Composed, also references some kind of authenticity that I feel at this point.
How difficult was it to find out who you were in the face of that extraordinary legacy?
Well, it was a challenge. I mean, I always say I think it would have been harder if I'd been a boy. But, you know, to go in the same field where my dad was cast such an iconic shadow, it was complicated for me. Fortunately, he understood how complicated it was.
He really did.
He did, and he he was not hurt or offended by the fact that I wanted to push away and not immerse myself in what he was doing. And very respectful, very loving.
When did you accompany him on his concert? How old were you?
Well, that was straight out of high school, and that was just, that was not a professional thing. That was just a chance to be with my dad.
And to be with him, to see him in his element, do you remember how you felt?
Well, of course, it wasn't the first time I had seen him on stage, but it was like immersion therapy to see him every night for, you know, nearly 3 years I was on that tour with him. And to see how he worked out all of his problems in the spotlight and how he had this unique relationship to an audience. He felt very safe with an audience, safer than anywhere else, I think. And that was... And I began to realize that I couldn't be resentful about sharing my dad with the world anymore because he had a large mission that was in the world.
It's interesting. You wrote that sometimes he would look out into the audience and see somebody yawn or somebody's eyes who were glazed, and he'd have to get past that.
Sure, I think any performer does. That happens to everyone. I wrote about that very thing in my book, about a friend told me I was complaining about having a bad night, I wasn't connecting with the audience, they weren't paying attention, whatever. And he said, sing to the 6% who are poets. They will always hear you. And I just keep that in mind. Whenever I'm having a tough time on stage or I'm not connecting, I think the 6% are out there.
And they're so with you.
They're so with me.
Absolutely. This is, seems to me, both a spiritual and kind of a metaphysical memoir.
And yet grounded in real-world artifacts and real-world experiences and memories. Spiritual in the most ecumenical sense of the word, I would say, meaning art and music are spiritual to me. The deepest kind of spirituality I find in art. So that is pretty much the framework to my book and my life, you know, how art can infuse everything.
You told your dad about working on this book in 2001,
yes,
when he was in a hospital. Would you read that portion
sure.
for us?
Now, this comes at the end of a chapter I wrote about a six-month sojourn in London when I was very young. I was 20 years old. And it was a coming-of-age experience for me. 25 years later, my dad was having a series of health crises, and he was in intensive care. And I visited him in the hospital and told him that I was writing this book. He harumphed emphatically, one of the peculiar ways he liked to communicate. I described one of the chapters to him. I'm sitting on a beach in Jamaica, staring at the sky and letting the tidal pull of my own future wash over me and draw me forward. I am full of my unlived life, and the joy of anticipation for it is taking me apart cell by cell and putting me back together in ways that could accommodate 1,000 potentials. I am certain to outgrow myself. I can feel it all coming for me, and I am running to meet it in my deepest heart in London. I was deliberately eloquent for him, describing my feelings in detail, the anticipation and the smell of the sea and the darkness, the brightness of the stars, my young, smooth feet in the sand, and the two silent boys at my side, like gargoyles protecting my dream. He grew still and stared straight ahead through the glass doors to the nurse's station while I talked. When I finished, he turned to me with surprise. "You got me with that chapter," he thought for a moment. "I didn't know you felt all those things then." Neither of us spoke for a moment or two. Then softly I said, "Well, I did." Dad's eyes glazed a bit, and he said quietly, "Just to think of you makes my heart swell with pride."
Beautiful.
Thank you.
And I'm sure that when you heard those words, you must have been so taken.
I still carry those words with me.
I'll bet.
Whenever things get hard, sometimes I think of those words. That was that moment that was the microcosm of my dad's love.
You said in those words, "I'm certain to outgrow myself." What did that mean?
I had that feeling that I think a lot of young people have, where you sense your potential, but it's beyond your reach still. And I wanted it so badly and had no idea how to get there. I wanted to be a great writer. I wanted to be a songwriter. I wanted to figure out who I was apart from my very big family, influential family. And I thought I might have to move across the ocean to discover all those things. And truly, that those 6 months in London were the beginning of me discovering that and feeling my potential just a little bit more. It took me years to start getting there.
Roseanne Cash, her new CD is titled The List, and her new memoir is Composed. We're going to open the phones in just a few moments. Join us, 800-433-8850.
I'm growing tired of the big city lights, tired of the glamour and tired of the sights.
Welcome back. Of course, you just heard Silver Wings, and Rufus Wainwright was also singing on that.
He comes
recording
in a little later than where we cut. Yes,
yes,
he's a wonderful singer.
Your parents actually split up when you were 12. Your dad married June Carter. What was your relationship with her?
It was very good. It didn't start out complicated like some step relationships did, and it never got that way really. I was very lucky that I had two very strong women in my life, my stepmother June, my mother Vivian, and they both provided opposite things.
Well, they were so different.
They were so different. My mother provided a lot of discipline, structure, kind of attention to detail. June provided this sense of expansion and a great template as a performer, because she was exactly the same off stage as she was on. It was really remarkable.
Now, when your father left your mother, Vivian, how did you feel about his leaving her behind?
Well, he didn't leave me behind. And I felt, even at the age of 12, 11 or 12, I thought, when I knew they were going to break up, I thought, well, maybe they both have a chance to be happy now. Mm-hmm. Of course, that is a very adult thing for a child to think, and I'm sure that I was compensating for my feelings in some way by giving it a philosophical, you know, overtone. But they did become happy apart from each other, and that just was for the better.
She was not comfortable with your father's public life.
Not only that, but at that time, you know, my father was deep in his addiction, and my mother had no understanding and was not equipped to deal with that.
How did she?
Well, she was angry. She got very bitter for a while, you know, and she was Catholic, too, so to get divorced back then, that was just, it was horrendous. She couldn't even conceive of it. So this really turned her life inside out.
And did you stay with her?
Yes.
For quite some time?
I did. I did see my dad. You know, like any divorced families, you see your father on weekends and holidays. But I grew up in Southern California with my mother.
And stayed with her until you were how old?
18. I actually left the day after I graduated from high school. And then I pieced together a little college along the way.
But then, you know, this time that you spent with your dad after high school had to really have had an impact on you.
An enormous impact. It was life-changing. And that was the tour that very summer that he gave me the list of songs, which I held up as, you know, how great songs were written. I studied these songs. I asked him how each one went. How does this go? How does this go? And that was what made me think I wanted to be a songwriter.
The song 500 Miles is from that list. Tell us about that song.
Well, that is a quintessential American song that's been covered by many, many people, Kingston Trio, Peter, Paul and Mary, Bobby Bear. And sometimes it's kind of a campfire song, but this version is very sad.
You can hear the whistle blow 100 miles. Teardrops fell on Mama's note when I read the things she wrote. She said, "We miss you, hon. We love you. Come on home." Well, I didn't have to pack. I had it all. From home. Lord, I'm one. Lord, I'm two. Lord, I'm three. Oh, Lord, I'm four. Lord, I'm 500 miles away from
daughter.
That was my daughter joining in on the end.
How wonderful.
She just released her first record last year. She's a wonderful songwriter.
You know,
I don't know where she gets it.
Considering the fact that you saw all the difficulties of a public life up close, it's remarkable that you chose to follow that route.
That shows, I think, the strength and passion I felt about music and writing. And I had to grow into a life as a performer because I was you know, I had children. I didn't want to leave them. And I have balanced that pretty well, I think. I have never gone on a really long tour because of my kids. But my mother had a lot of anxiety about that lifestyle, about a musician's lifestyle. I mean, from what she knew, you got addicted to drugs.
Right.
You were always gone and your
right.
marriage fell apart. Why
right.
would you want to do this? But I've, you know, got a happy marriage, not on drugs, raised my children, and I love my life.
You've, however, had some pretty serious medical problems.
Yes, I have.
And before the program began, you were warming up your voice, mm. something every performer has to do. But you had some particular problems with your voice for a while.
I did. I lost my voice for 2.5 years. I had vocal polyps, and I got pregnant, and for some reason, the hormones of pregnancy made them grow and grow and grow, which
wow.
is kind of science fiction, but it's true.
Wow.
And I didn't know if I'd ever get my voice back, and it really shook me to the core. I had always thought of myself as a writer, but then losing my voice made me realize how deeply important and precious my voice was to me.
And then the polyp simply disappeared, or
they did after I finished nursing my baby, and the hormones settled back down. It took a long time. It took 2.5 years, but then my voice was wrecked, and I had to rebuild it from scratch.
But they did not have to
do surgery.
Remove.
Thank God.
Yes, but then then
I had brain surgery.
Why?
I had a structural problem in my brain. The short version is that my cerebellum was too low and it was crushing my brain stem. So I was really, headaches for years, but I was becoming incapacitated. It was getting worse. And my husband was so great, greatest patient advocate ever, and found the best neurosurgeon. And I'm doing well. I mean, it's been a hard recovery, but I'm doing very well.
How long ago was
2.5 years.
Just 2.5
yeah.
years.
The first year was very tough.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
And now here you are.
And here I am.
With a new CD and a new memoir.
Yeah. Looking at your own mortality lends a sense of urgency about the things you want to do in your life. And when I started to recover, I thought, what do I really want to do? I want to finish this book. I want to make the list. So I've done those two things.
How are your children? How old are they now?
My stepdaughter, Hannah, who I claim is my own, is 34. And Caitlin is 30. Chelsea, 28. She's the one who just made the record. Carrie is 21, just left home. She's in college, and she just moved out of the house. It just broke both our hearts. And my son, Jake, is 11.
Wow.
So I've covered the spectrum of motherhood.
You really, really have. We've got a number of callers, and here's a message from Dee on Facebook, who says, Roseanne Cash is an amazing singer and songwriter. I'd like to know when she wrote her first song, and did performing come naturally, coming from such a talented family?
There's two different questions. I wrote my first song
right.
or my first good song?
That's a good question.
Right. I wrote my first song at 18. I wrote my first good song at 21.
What happened to the song you wrote at 18?
Oh, hundreds of them, Diane.
That I tossed, trying
to learn the
right.
craft. Performing did not come naturally. I had to grow into that. Because I was naturally pretty reticent. I didn't feel I wanted that much attention. And also, I had a great performer as a parent. And I thought, well, I don't have a right to do this same thing. He's so special. But, you know, you find out who you are on the stage.
Do you remember that very first performance?
Terrified. Northern California. My first record came out. I was just paralyzed with fear, but I got through it. I met somebody the other day who was at that performance, and he said he just remembers how scared I was.
Do you remember the song you sang?
Oh, I did a whole show.
You did?
Yeah, I did a whole show. I was totally ill-equipped, but that's something else I talk about in the book. If you just keep your head down and keep showing up and keep doing the work, it'll come.
I had the same feeling.
Yes.
Same experience.
Well, you can tell that you've done that through your life.
You just keep showing up.
Right.
And that's what you have to do. September, when it comes, tell me about that song.
That song, I wrote the lyrics when my dad was in another very ill health crisis, and we were afraid of losing him. So it's a song about mortality. My husband wrote the music to it, and I recorded it with my dad, the first thing we did together like this.
I plan to crawl outside these walls, close my eyes and see, and fall into the heart and arms of those who wait for me. I cannot move a mountain now, I can no longer run. I cannot be who I was then, in a way I never was.
Watch the clouds go sailing, watch the clock and sun. Oh, I watch myself depending on
September. When it comes.
Hard for you to hear this one.
Yeah, I never listen to it because it's too bittersweet, you know. It's like the ultimate family photograph.
Such beautiful voices combined.
You know what my dad told me once? He saw this voice doctor at Vanderbilt. A very famous voice doctor. And the doctor said to him, do you think your voice and your daughter Roseanne's voice are similar? And my dad said, not at all. They couldn't be more different. And the doctor said, I've done this spectrum analysis on him. He said, they're identical.
Wow. Wow.
I couldn't believe it.
And he told you that?
Yeah, my dad told me.
What was he like to be with?
He was propelled by rhythm, always feeling rhythm and thinking about rhythm. So he had all these nervous tics, you know, he was always moving. He was a very restless person and always very and dreamy, too. You know, he thought differently than anyone I've ever known and incredibly intelligent, had this expansive understanding of art, music, spirituality, and the world that was very unique. And he could meet you on that level even as a child, when you were a child, you know. He found who you are and met you.
Did he behave differently toward you when he was in the throes of addiction?
Of course. Someone who's an active addict is just an awful person to be around. You know, Marshall Grant, who was my dad's bass player for many years, said there were two people. You know, there was Johnny Cash when he was an active addict, and then there was John.
But there was also Johnny Cash, Roseanne Cash's father.
Even when he was in his active phase of addiction, his destruction was turned inward. He was never unkind to us children. He might be distant and, you know, crazed, but even in that, there was this. He would write us letters. There was always an impulse to stay a dad.
What kinds of letters?
I miss you. I'm in Poland tonight. I've got two shows tomorrow. Then I'll see you on the weekend. You know, call me. Here's my number.
Those of course, guys. That was before the days of
faxes
Skype.
Even.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. You must have missed him a lot.
I still do. Sometimes, when I really miss him, I'll get in a taxi or walk in a store and he'll be on the radio. And it feels like getting a hug.
or you come onto a radio program.
Well, and, that know. Song in particular is very hard to
listen to. Yeah. What about his performances with June Carter Cash?
Oh, they were funny together. You know, she had a great comedic streak, and that would come out when they performed together. My dad softened around her visibly. He softened around most women. You know, he was kind of a man's man, but he loved women and would, you know, bring it down a notch.
Bringing it down a notch meant being more warm, giving,
of course,
kinder,
sweeter, pretending to be interested in things that women were interested in.
Roseanne Cash, her new memoir is titled Composed. Her latest CD is The List.
On a cold, dark night, there was someone killed. Neath the town hall light, there were few at the scene, but they all did agree that the slayer who ran looked a lot like me.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
Police were stumped by the murder of a restaurant manager until Richard Walter saw the crime scene and concluded it wasn't a robbery.
I found then that the primary focus was an intense anger against the victim.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Richard Walter about investigating cold cases and with Michael Capuzzo, author of The Murder Room. Join us.
Roseanne Cash is with me. Her new memoir is titled Composed. Her latest CD is The List. And by the way, on our website, you can see a film of Roseanne Cash with her dad, family photos, and a film I think you'll enjoy. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Ogden, Utah. Doug, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
Roseanne, I want to comment on your comment you made earlier, in that younger people, they seem to start to realize their potential, but it's just out of their grasp.
Mm-hmm.
I have two girls, 15 and 17, and I see that they sometimes get impatient, and they want to grasp that potential, and I keep telling them, work on building that foundation. Don't worry about what's going to come later. Your potential will come. And I think your comment that you made earlier that the potential is just out of their reach is, it's like a bullet hitting you. It's well, why didn't I think of that before? I mean, it sounds so simple, but you put it in a text that's so easy to understand, and I just want to thank you for making that comment.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. And now to Howell, Massachusetts. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller.
Oh, good.
And it is quite an honor to be allowed to ask a question, Ms. Cash, and it relates to her songwriting process. I'm wondering if it is always a lyric-driven or melody-driven process, and how that contrasts to iconic father's way that she wrote music.
Well, you know, it's a very private kind of experience, so I can't even say how my father wrote. I know that sometimes he got inspiration from dreams, and I know also that he was very much propelled by rhythm, so sometimes he would fill a rhythm before he felt a lyric. For myself, there's no formula. Sometimes a lyric will stay in my head for weeks or months, and I'll finally flesh it out and then find the melody. The best for me is when it comes together at the same time.
Gosh.
And then I feel like, oh, tingly in the head, and I'm so happy.
How often does that happen?
Often enough that I keep doing it.
Ah, that's great.
Thank you. That was a good question. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Peter. Here's a message from Bill in Gainesville, Florida. He says, Ms. Cash's The List is the best new album I've heard in a long time. Does she have any plans to make more albums based on her father's list? And if so, when?
When? The answer is yes.
Good.
And also, I don't know when. I don't think it'll be my next record. I want to, you know, kind of restate my claim as a songwriter again, but definitely I'm going to do volume two of The List.
You know, you are such a talented individual. You actually took a painting. Tell me about that process.
That was an exercise that I took up to free myself of words for a while. Was so working with words and language and melody all the time. I wanted to see what it felt like to give all that up and just work with a physical medium, with paint. It was so revealing because I saw that what I did in painting, the self-editing, the self-criticism, the insecurities, the process was exactly the same as songwriting. Exactly. So I was happy to have that knowledge to go back to songwriting with. And then when I returned to language and melody, it was so fresh and wonderful. I'm not a good painter.
But you had courage enough to try to paint.
Yeah.
And had you painted as a child?
No, never. I never had any confidence as a visual artist.
Nor I.
Yeah.
And yet, once you begin, you know, you can surprise yourself.
Right. And even just the process of it is so wonderful, you know. I mean, you know, it's not going to hang in a gallery or anything, but it was great for me.
And it does something else. It touches on some part of you that perhaps had not been revealed to you.
Exactly. I had a much greater understanding of myself as a writer after spending a couple years painting.
You know, I once spent some time learning to draw, which I, from elementary school, had believed I could not do. And yet, through a process, I turned things upside down and was able to draw beautifully.
That's so interesting. You stimulated a part of your brain that had been just waiting.
Precisely. You've touched exactly on it. All right, let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning. I just wondered what Ms. Cash thought of the movie Walk the Line, that portrayed her father was Joaquin Phoenix.
Well, I thought about it probably what you would think about a Hollywood film about the most painful parts of your childhood. It was not a pleasant experience for me. I understood that other people like it, and some people even introduced to my dad's music through it. It's great. It just wasn't for me and my family. You know what I mean? It was too complex of a story to be reduced to 2 hours.
Mm. And perhaps too personal in some ways and not personal enough in others.
Well, you know the movie Ray about Ray Charles?
Yes.
I loved that movie.
Yes.
I loved it. But I bet if you talked to Ray Charles' children or his wives or his brothers and sisters, they would say, well, it wasn't exactly like that for me.
Let's go now to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Eddie.
Good morning. Roseanne, I just want, my comment is, I was at your sister Tara's wedding in Hendersonville at your dad's house.
Wow.
And I met you, I was introduced to you, and of course I met your father, and he had just finished his meal in the tent. Remember they had that big tent out there?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, yes, and I went up to him, and I said, Mr. Cash, my name is Eddie. It's an honor to meet. He stood up, he shook my hand and said, Eddie, just call me Johnny.
Well, that was him. He was always very kind and gracious to people.
And that was it. And it was just such a great experience. And the home was off limits, but, Tara took me in and showed me the room with all his all his awards and things like that. So it was a wonderful experience for me.
Well,
so
she was always a rebel.
When you say she was a rebel, what do you mean?
Oh, just I'm teasing. I'm actually closest to Tara. She's my baby sister. She lives in Portland, Oregon. She's a great person.
To Ogden, Utah. Good morning, Alice.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've just piqued my curiosity because Ms. Cash, picked up being an artist or painting. And I have a nephew who is in Portland, Oregon, and he's in the music business, and he's very talented. And I just want to know what advice to give to him. He's an artist. He, plays music instruments, and he paints. And he just seems to be wandering, and he didn't have the base that Ms. Cash had as, a platform and foundation. And what advice can I give to him? I'm not sure, what to tell him, which way to go or what to do. I just,
Well, the best advice that was given to me was refine your skills so you can support your instincts. Meaning those great impulses and passion that he feels for the things that he wants, he needs to have a skill set and discipline to support that so that when that inspiration comes, he has the tools to translate it. Do you know what I mean? So that's the best advice I got. And I worked hard. Like I said, I just kept showing up for myself.
Alice, I hope that helps.
Yeah, do you mean like education, like going into, actually being, because he's like self-taught.
Mm-hmm. That's okay. My husband is self-taught, and he's one of the greatest musicians I know.
So
maybe the education comes from his own self.
Exactly. Thanks for calling, Alice. Roseanne, you had to write 4 eulogies in a period of about 2 years. How did you get through that?
I said, I don't mind going to funerals, but I'm sick of sitting in the front row. the writing was actually therapeutic for me. It was an organizing principle for my feelings. The feelings were overwhelming, and yet if I could bring some poetry to it or organize it as a, an essay, then it helped. And also it was a matter of honor. I wanted to honor these people and say what they had meant to me. They deserved that.
There was your father.
Mm-hmm.
There was your stepsister, Rosie. Mm-hmm. How did she die?
Rosie was an addict, and the circumstances of her death are a little bit murky, but it was definitely related to her addiction. She had a very tough life. And I was so sad. She was in her 40s. And died 6 weeks after my dad.
Oh.
She was June's daughter. It was strange because her name was Rosie and mine, Roseanne. And so a lot of times people confused us. And I loved her, but it was almost like having a doppelganger in the world.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So you spoke at her service.
I did.
As well. Tell me about the song, Sea of Heartbreak.
That song was written by Hal David and Paul Hampton, and was first made famous in 1961 by Don Gibson, one of the great, great voices in country music. And it's also been covered by everyone from punk bands to Irish bands to my dad did it as well on one of the American recordings. And that song is on the list.
Shine for me. And I'm like a lost ship adrift on the sea. Sea of heartbreak, lost love, loneliness, memories of your caress. So divine, I wish you were mine again, my dear. On the sea of tears, sea of heartbreak.
Of course, that's Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce Springsteen doing a duet with me. Who could have ever imagined?
How did that come about?
We asked him. I mean, John and I are thinking, who is the quintessential American male voice to sing a duet with you on this? He said, well, that's Bruce Springsteen. Do you think he'll do it? Let's ask. And he said, yes. I've known him on and off for, 25 years, but it was such a thrill. And then I played at Duke University a few months ago, and he came to the show, and John said, I hate to ask the obvious, but would you sing Sea of Heartbreak? And so he came out and sang it. The audience went crazy.
Memories of your caress, so divine. I wish you were mine again, my dear. On the sea of tears, sea of heartbreak, lost love.
How I loved hearing that.
Oh, thank
just
you.
Wonderful. There's a last song I want to play from your CD, The List. It's the one with just you and your husband, John Leventhal, Barry Mander, The Weeping Willow.
This is a Carter family song. This is perhaps the oldest song on the list. And Helen Carter taught it to me herself.
My heart is sad and I'm in sorrow for the only one I love. When shall I see him? Oh, no, never till we meet in heaven above. Oh,
Roseanne Cash singer-songwriter. Her new memoir is titled Composed, and her latest CD is The List. What a pleasure to talk with you.
I have enjoyed this so much, Diane. Thank
the
you.
The hour has been too short.
I agree.
Come back and see me again.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
He has proven untrue to you. Oh, bury me beneath the willow, under the weeping willow tree, so he may know where I am sleeping, and perhaps he'll weep for me.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.
Tomorrow was our wedding day.